KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And I am saying it clear and loud.
Yes.
To President Trump and his cabinet.
Yes.
I am not afraid of you.
Columbia University student and Palestinian activist Mohsen Mahdawi has been released from an immigration jail in Vermont after a federal judge compared the targeting of student activists to McCarthyism and the Red Scare. We'll hear Mohsen Mahdawi in his own words and speak to one of his attorneys. Then it's May Day. As protests call for worker and immigrant rights, we'll talk to a New York father whose 19-year-old son was detained in the Bronx, then flown with over 230 other Venezuelans to a notorious mega prison in El Salvador, where he's being held incommunicado.
My message to Merwill, if he hears me, he is to be strong. God is with us, and he needs to know that we are doing everything possible to get him out of there soon. His family in Venezuela is doing everything they can. Just like me here, I am making my voice heard so that it is heard and reaches the ears of everyone, and that justice is done, because I told you from my heart, he is not a criminal.
Plus, as the United States and Ukraine sign a new rare earth minerals deal, we'll speak to environmental reporter Antonia Yuhas. Her recent piece, Is Trump's Minerals Deal a Fossil Fuel Shakedown? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in Vermont has granted bail and released from ICE jail Palestinian Columbia University student Mohsen Mahdawi while he challenges the Trump administration's efforts to deport him for joining protests against Israel's assault on Gaza. U.S. District Judge Jeffrey Crawford ruled the Trump administration failed to show why Mahdawi should remain in confinement, condemning, quote, chilling action by the government intended to shut down debate, the judge said. Mohsen Mahdawi emerged from the courthouse to a jubilant crowd of supporters, both arms in the air, holding up the V for victory sign with his hands, also the gesture for peace.
And I am saying it clear and loud.
Yes.
To President Trump and his cabinet.
Yes.
I am not afraid of you.
Yeah! Mohsen Mahdawi also asked the crowd to join him in singing We Shall Overcome. Mahdawi was jailed by ICE in April after appearing for what he was told would be a naturalization test. He was a lead organizer in Colombia's Gaza solidarity protests, the former president of Colombia's Buddhist Association. We'll get the latest on his case after headlines with a member of Mohsen Mahdawi's legal defense team. Israel's military is continuing its unrelenting attacks on Gaza, killing at least 18 Palestinians today. Israel's killed at least 2,300 Palestinians since it unilaterally ended the ceasefire in mid-March. More than 64,000 Palestinians have been killed since October 2023, and that number is expected to be a far underestimate. The assault continued as the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, warned the lives of 1 million Palestinian children in Gaza are on the line as Israel's total blockade on the territory enters its 61st day. Some 3,000 aid trucks are lined up at Gaza's border but unable to enter. The blockade has compounded a healthcare crisis with no medicines or equipment entering Gaza and patients unable to leave for treatment elsewhere. This is the mother of a sick 3-year-old child being treated at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis.
Doctors prescribe treatments that aren't even available to get from the pharmacies here. My daughter needs this medicine, but it's not available. It's not available anywhere in Gaza's pharmacies. It has to come from outside, and the occupation has closed the crossing and refuses to let medicines through.
This comes as arguments continue at the International Court of Justice over Israel's obligations to provide aid to Gaza. A U.S. State Department lawyer Wednesday defended Israel's ban on UNRWA.
UNRWA is not the only option for providing humanitarian assistance in Gaza. In sum, there is no legal requirement that an occupying power permit a specific third state or international organization to conduct activities in occupied territory that would compromise its security interest.
Israel's Channel 13 has aired a report detailing how the administration of former President Joe Biden allowed Israel to carry out its slaughter in Gaza with total impunity, with one senior official admitting it amounted to, quote, killing and destroying for the sake of killing and destroying, unquote. In Syria, at least 30 people have been killed in recent days amidst violent clashes between government forces and armed groups on the outskirts of Damascus. Israel intervened by launching air attacks on Syria, claiming it was defending the local Druze community. Syria immediately condemned all forms of foreign intervention, unquote. The transitional Syrian government, which came to power after the ouster of President Bashar al-Assad in December, has said its restored order in the region is committed to protecting all communities in Syria. U.S. and Ukrainian officials signed a deal late Wednesday that'll give the U.S. a stake in Ukraine's mineral reserves as part of a joint investment fund with Kyiv. Details of the deal have yet to be released, including any guarantees of U.S. security assistance for Ukraine. Trump has sought to frame the agreement as repayment for U.S. military aid to Ukraine since Russia's invasion in February 2022. The Ukrainian parliament will still need to ratify the deal. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent spoke after the signing of the agreement.
Today's agreement signals clearly to Russian leadership that the Trump administration is committed to a peace process centered on a free, sovereign, and prosperous Ukraine over the long term. It's time for this cruel and senseless war to end.
We'll have more on the story later in the broadcast with investigative journalist Antonia Juhas. Her recent piece is Trump's Minerals Deal, a Fossil Fuel Shakedown. The Trump administration has spoken to leaders of Libya and Rwanda about the possibility of sending undocumented immigrants to those two countries. That's according to CNN, which reports the U.S. is also seeking a so-called safe third country agreement that would allow the U.S. to send asylum seekers to Libya, including people with no criminal records. This comes as President Trump said in an ABC News interview, he has the power to bring back a Maryland father the U.S. government admitted to expelling to an El Salvador prison in error, but that he will not do so, despite court orders mandating the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. Trump was interviewed by ABC's Terry Moran.
This is not an innocent, wonderful gentleman from Maryland.
I'm not saying he's a good guy. It's about the rule of law. The order from the Supreme Court stands, sir.
He came into our country illegally.
You could get him back. There's a phone on this desk.
I could.
You could pick it up, and with all the power of the presidency, you could call up the president of El Salvador and say, send him back right now.
And if he were the gentleman that you say he is, I would do that.
The comments contradict previous White House statements the U.S. has no power to return Abrego Garcia. During the interview, Trump grew increasingly agitated and repeatedly interrupted Terry Moran to falsely claim Abrego Garcia had tattoos on his knuckles reading MS-13, a reference to the MS-13 gang. In fact, those characters were photoshopped into a picture of tattooed symbols on Abrego Garcia's left hand shared by the White House on social media. Moran made this point in the interview. In Texas, a group of 31 Venezuelan men facing possible deportation to El Salvador's Sicat prison, notorious for its torture and human rights abuses, used their bodies to spell out a cry for help Monday after they spotted a news drone flying above the immigration jail where they're being held. The men formed the letters SOS in a human formation in the courtyard of the Blue Bonnet Detention Facility, which is operated by the For-Profit Management and Training Corporation. A federal judge in Miami has ordered Florida police departments to stop deputizing officers to act as immigration enforcement agents. U.S. District Judge Kathleen Williams' order came as she prepared to issue a preliminary injunction against a new state law that makes it a misdemeanor for undocumented immigrants to enter Florida by eluding immigration agents. In California, a federal judge has issued a preliminary injunction barring Border Patrol officers from stopping people without reasonable suspicion that they're undocumented and preventing them from making warrantless arrests unless they have credible evidence a person is likely to flee. The injunction follows reports that Border Patrol agents carrying out raids in California's Central Valley rounded up day laborers and farm workers, regardless of their actual immigration status, rather than fulfilling their mission of arresting immigrants with serious criminal backgrounds. In Burkina Faso, thousands of people rallied in support of the interim president, Ibrahim Traoré, on Wednesday after military rulers said they foiled a plot to overthrow his transitional government. He seized power after a 2022 coup and moved to end military ties with the former colonizer, France. Protesters also condemned recent comments by General Michael Langley, head of the U.S. military's Africa Command, who accused Traoré of using Burkina Faso's gold reserves to benefit himself rather than the people. This is a protester in Ouagadougou.
Words like democracy, human rights, no one can teach that in Africa. The African continent was the first continent that produced democracy, but not that of the West, which consists of burning countries, burning continents that do not think like them. Here we are today so that our country remains standing, so that our continent remains standing.
Protesters took to the streets of Panama City Wednesday to condemn the signing of a memorandum between the U.S. and Panama that would allow U.S. troops to deploy around the Panama Canal for military training.
We protest because they have stomped over the sovereignty of entire generations who have fought. They dumped our sovereignty to the trash by signing a memorandum of understanding that allows foreign military presence in Panama. Down with the memorandum. Down with the memorandum. Sovereign Panama.
President Trump has repeatedly threatened to take back the Panama Canal, as he's pledged to annex Canada. In Mexico, rights groups are demanding justice for Marco Antonio Suastegui, an environmental activist from Guerrero State who was shot 2 weeks ago and died on Friday. Suastegui helped lead the successful grassroots resistance against the La Perota hydroelectric dam project, which would have devastated the local community. In Pennsylvania, students at Swarthmore College set up a new protest encampment, naming the site the Hossam Shabbat Liberated Zone, in honor of the 23-year-old Palestinian journalist killed by Israel in Gaza in March. Students are demanding Swarthmore, quote, divest from Israeli occupation, aggression, and apartheid and declare itself a sanctuary campus, unquote. And tens of thousands of people are taking to the streets across the United States for May Day, International Workers' Day. Over 1,000 actions in more than 1,000 cities will protest the Trump administration's policies. Worker-led demonstrations are also taking place in countries across the globe. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Vermont, where Columbia University student and Palestinian activist Mohsen Mahdawi was released after more than 2 weeks in U.S. immigration custody. Mahdawi is a green card holder from Palestine who was born and raised in a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. He was arrested on April 14th when he appeared for what he was told would be a citizenship interview. Mahdawi had participated in the Palestinian solidarity protests at Columbia last year. He was also president of the Columbia University Buddhist Association. He was freed on bail on Wednesday by U.S. District Judge Jeffrey Crawford, who criticized the Trump administration's handling of the case. In his ruling, Crawford wrote that Mahdawi had made, quote, substantial claims that his detention is the result of a retaliation for protected speech that he engaged in as a college student on the Columbia campus. Crawford went on to write, quote, the court also considers the extraordinary setting of this case and others like it. Legal residents not charged with crimes or misconduct are being arrested and threatened with deportation for stating their views on the political issues of the day. Our nation has seen times like this before, especially during the Red Scare and Palmer raids of 1919-1920 that led to the deportation of hundreds of people suspected of anarchist or communist views, Crawford wrote.
After Mohsen Mahdawi left the federal courthouse in Burlington, Vermont, he addressed supporters.
And we send a clear message as well that if we have faith in our beliefs, unshakable beliefs, which is the belief that justice is inevitable. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
We will not fear anyone because our fight is a fight for love, is a fight for democracy, is a fight for humanity.
Amen. Yes.
And I am saying it clear and loud.
Yes.
To President Trump and his cabinet.
Yes.
I am not afraid of you.
Yes!
Never give up on the idea that justice will prevail and that we have to come together to bring our voices and our hearts and raise them. Not only for America, not only for this system of democracy that has checks and balances and this court is part of it, but also for our humanity. We have to restore and reform the international order and abide by international law as a first step towards justice. We must stand up for humanity because the rest of the world, not only Palestine, is watching us. And what is going to happen in America is going to affect the rest of the world.
That's right.
Yeah.
I will end up by saying to my people in Palestine, I feel your pain. I see you suffering. And I see the freedom. And it is very, very soon.
Yeah.
Free, free Palestine.
Columbia University student and Palestinian activist Mohsen Mahdawi, speaking in Burlington, Vermont, Wednesday after he was freed after over 2 weeks in an immigration jail. We're joined now by a member of his legal team, Shaza Abushi Dalal. She's a staff attorney with the CLEAR Project at CUNY School of Law. Shaza, thank you so much for being with us. I know you've just returned from Vermont, where you were with Mohsen. Can you talk about the significance of what the judge ruled and what are the conditions of Mohsen's release?
Thank you for having me, Amy. I can't overstate the significance of this ruling and the fact that Mohsen walked free yesterday and wakes up today in his home in Vermont. Not in an ICE detention facility being punished for speaking out for Palestinian lives and freedom and against the genocide in Gaza. The judge yesterday ruled, ordered him released on bail. And this is, you know, release on his own recognizance. So he will be able to return to his home in Vermont, continue his studies at Columbia University, complete his undergraduate degree and continue on to a master's program in the fall, and continue his advocacy for Palestinian life and dignity and freedom. And that's of paramount importance to him. And it was of paramount importance to the judge too. The judge acknowledged that, you know, this is on a backdrop of a chapter of U.S. history that is repressive and evocative of moments before, where the government attempts to wield, you know, the immigration system, detention, to punish people for their First Amendment protected speech, for their political advocacy, and the judge situated his decision on that backdrop, in that context.
So, Shaza, as you said, he can come back to New York. He can return to his studies at Columbia, begin his master's degree next year. Are there any other restrictions on his movement? In other words, he can come from Vermont to New York, but can he go anywhere else? And what is the remaining immigration case against him?
So he's released pending the culmination of his federal litigation, so his habeas litigation in federal court in Vermont. And so the conditions reflect that. He, you know, his court case is in Vermont, so he needs to stay around close to the court, close to the court's jurisdiction in order to see that process through. And that's what that's going to look like.
And the Trump administration initially did want to move him as well, Mohsen, to the same Louisiana immigration jail that Mahmoud Khalil, two other students, Romesa Ozturk, are held in. How come he was not sent to Louisiana but to Vermont instead?
That's exactly right. The administration was playing the same card and attempting to do the same exact thing that they did with Mahmoud Khalil, Romesa Ozturk, Badr Khan Suri. They took him, abducted him at his naturalization interview in the final moments after he had signed, saying that he would take an oath to the Constitution. Masked men entered the room and abducted him. And then they attempted to swiftly take him to the airport in order to commence a route towards Louisiana. And the only thing that stopped him is Mohsen's legal team's intervention. They filed the habeas petition before they had the opportunity to put him on a flight. And in fact, they took him all the way to the airport and missed a flight out from Burlington, Vermont at the very last moment. So we had the benefit of having learned what the Trump administration's playbook is on all of these cases, to whisk people, abduct them, take them away from their communities into fora that are favorable for the government, and then present a series of delay tactics in their federal court proceedings on the basis of the fact that they are now in another state like Louisiana. And so ultimately, Mohsen was able to remain in his home state of Vermont, surrounded by his community, and anybody who's seen footage or had the fortune of being at court or in front of court yesterday in the District of Vermont was able to see the power of that community and how people showed up in outrage at what is happening to Mohsen and all the other people like Mahmoud and Rumaysa and Badr Khan Suri, who do not have the benefit of being in their home state and are still waiting to have their motions for release heard by the respective federal courts that they are in.
And so in the case of Rumaysa, the Fulbright scholar from Tufts, the international graduate student, a federal judge has ruled her case must be heard in Vermont, but she is still in Louisiana being held there because she was moved there. Shaza, so Mohsen gets to come to New York for graduation at Columbia University?
Yes, he does.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Shaza Abushi-Dalal, staff attorney with the CLEAR Project at CUNY School of Law and a member of Mohsen Madawi's legal defense team. She's just back from Vermont here in New York as she was with him yesterday as he was released. When we come back, today is May Day, massive protests planned across the country. We'll talk to a New York father whose 19-year-old son was detained in the Bronx, then flown with 230 other Venezuelans to a notorious mega prison in El Salvador, where he's being held incommunicado. Stay with us.
Yeah.
Mohsen Mahdawi singing Spirit of Life with his supporters after he was released Wednesday in Burlington, Vermont, from an ICE jail. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
May Day demonstrations are underway worldwide, with mass protests across the United States today focused on workers' rights and resistance to the Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants and asylum seekers, including the transfer of over 230 men to El Salvador's terrorism confinement center, CECOT, infamous for its human rights abuses. The protests come amid reports the Trump administration is seeking to send immigrants with criminal records to Rwanda and Libya. That's according to CNN, which also reports the U.S. is seeking to send some asylum seekers apprehended at the U.S. border to Libya, including people with no criminal records. This is Secretary of State Marco Rubio speaking at a cabinet meeting Wednesday, sitting next to President Trump.
We are actively searching for other countries to take people from third countries. So we are actively, not just El Salvador, we are working with other countries to say, we want to send you some of the most despicable human beings to your countries. Will you do that as a favor to us? And the further away from America, the better, so they can't come back across the border.
This week, President Trump said he has the power to bring back Maryland father Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who the U.S. government admitted to expelling to an El Salvador prison in error, but that he will not do so, despite court orders. It's been 2 months since the Trump administration rounded up and transferred 238 Venezuelan immigrants from the U.S. to the notorious maximum security mega prison in El Salvador. The men are being held incommunicado without access to their attorneys or relatives, languishing in what appears to be indefinite detention in CECOT.
This week, Democracy Now! Spoke to the father of a 19-year-old Venezuelan teenager who is among them. His name is Merwil Gutierrez. He was detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE agents, outside his apartment here in New York in the Bronx on February 24th. He was sent to El Salvador despite having an open asylum case in the U.S. Merwil's family and lawyers note he has no criminal history, no tattoos, one of the features Trump officials have used to wrongfully accuse Venezuelan immigrants and others of being gang members and to expel them from the country without due process under the wartime Alien Enemies Act of 1798. Merwil's cousin, Luis Acosta, witnessed the February arrest from his window. He described seeing at least 10 officers ambushing Merwil and questioning him. His cousin says authorities were searching for a different person, but they forcibly took Merwil away anyway, knowing he was not that person. One of the officers grabbed the teen by the arm and put him inside a car. Merwil's father, Wilmer Gutierrez, says he's been unable to communicate with his son since he was taken to an ICE jail in Texas, then transferred to El Salvador in March. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I spoke with Wilmer Gutierrez through a translator. We were also joined by Ithar El Katatni, editor-in-chief of Documented, a nonprofit newsroom focusing on New York's immigrant community that broke Merwil's story in a report headlined, ICE took his son from their Bronx home. Now his 19-year-old is in Bukele's mega prison in El Salvador. It was written by Paz Radovich. I began by asking Wilmer Gutierrez to describe what happened to his son.
Buenos días. Mi nombre es Wilmer. Soy el padre de Merwil Gutierrez.
Good morning. My name is Wilmer. I'm Merwil Gutierrez's father. The day he was arrested, he was entering the building where we live. That day, I was working, and my nephew called me and told me that my son was being grabbed by the police to take him away without explanation. They were apparently looking for another person, and they grabbed my son, handcuffed him, and put him in the car. One of the policemen asked him his name. He replied that it is Merwil, and the policeman said, no, he's not who we want. Since the good ones are the bad ones too, the other police said, no, take him anyway. And they took my son to the precinct. I returned to the precinct. I thought that he was going to be released that same night, and they were going to let him go back home, because I know my son was not doing anything wrong. He was just going into our building when they arrested him.
Mr. Gutierrez, could you tell us when did you learn that he had been transferred to El Salvador?
I found out that they had sent him to El Salvador when he contacted me Saturday morning.
El día sábado en la mañana. Y de allí no tuve más comunicación.
And from that point on, I had no further communication with him.
Salieron los vuelos a El Salvador que habían llevado un...
When they were sending flights to El Salvador, we learned that they had taken a group of Venezuelans. At that time, they had not sent any planes deporting Venezuelans to their home country. We inquired, but couldn't obtain any information until a list of names of everyone who was deported came out, and my son's name was on that list.
Do you feel betrayed by the government, that the same government that allowed you to come into the United States with humanitarian parole has now sent your son to another country to prison?
Sí, efectivamente, efectivamente, porque o sea, nosotros vinimos para acá con un sueño.
Yes, indeed. Because we came here with a dream, we did not think that this injustice was ever going to happen. My son has not committed any crime. He never appeared in front of a court. He was not charged with a crime or had a trial.
Algún tipo de cargo, algo así, no. Ellos lo agarraron y se lo llevaron a todos a un avión y lo llevaron y...
No, they grabbed him and then put him on a plane and took him to El Salvador. And that's where they have sent others. They were kidnapped because they did not go through a formal process, nor did they sign any papers saying where they were going.
Ellos tenían la esperanza que si lo montaban en un avión, iban a regresar a Venezuela.
We hope that if they put him on a plane, they would return my son to Venezuela, where we have family. And look where he ended up, where his rights as a human being are being violated right now. They shattered our dreams.
I want to bring Ithar El-Khattatny into this conversation, the editor-in-chief of Documented. As we hear this utterly painful story that Wilmer conveys about his teenage son being taken to the notorious Salvadoran prison, I want to go back to that night, February 24th, as your reporter at Documented has told the story, interviewed the cousin. Explain exactly what he saw and heard the agents doing.
Thanks, Amy, for having me. Thank you for sharing your story so honestly. And I think before I just get to that, I just wanted to add that, you know, when we hear about the numbers and you hear 238 kind of deported, it's kind of sometimes easy to forget that these are real human lives and real impact. You know, an investigation showed that out of those 238 young people, nearly 75% of them actually have no criminal record, right? And we had documented or continuing to follow similar stories, other young men in their early 20s who also have no criminal records and who are also deported. So part of what we do at Documented, which is so unique, which is we are directly connected to immigrant communities, right? And we actually found the story through WhatsApp. Has our reporter is in a group where she actually managed to get in touch with Wilmer. So when we sent her to the community, obviously developing kind of trust, being able to discuss with his family. So Luis, who has actually left now their apartment out of fear that he would also be kind of caught up in a collateral arrest, which is exactly what we think was happening here. He was upstairs and actually saw it through a window. He said he saw nearly a dozen agents kind of gathering around. And what really made this so unique, which is he heard one agent talking about how this isn't who they were looking for, and another agent say, but take him anyway. And I would say that kind of pervasive fear that we're seeing now in immigrant communities, which is even if you have no criminal record, even if you have status, even if you have a legal case, even if the Supreme Court has argued that you have a right to argue against your deportation, you might still be taken away. So this case, as tragic as it is, we're seeing it play out in multiple ways across the country and in New York. Mm.
So talk about how the administration has responded. I mean, even when they publicly say, as in the case of Kilmer, they publicly say they made a mistake, they also say they're not going to bring back Kilmer Abrego Garcia. Yeah. They said it in court to a judge. But talk about what the how the Trump administration has responded and what access that Wilmer has to the courts right now.
Yeah. I would say that in this case, you know, the administration talked about it being an administrative error, right? And having no right, which is a step kind of even beyond in Kilmer's case, that it was an administrative error and that we can't do anything. So even if you have the courts now saying that they actually have to facilitate his return, the administration actually isn't doing anything. And now you have kind of a search and proceedings to see, like, are they actually stopping this? I would say in Wilmer's case, he's gotten a lot of media attention. But up until this day, even though we talked directly to, you know, politicians across the spectrum. We directly had an exclusive statement from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez expressing kind of, you know, their disillusionment, their disappointment, their kind of, we will take action. To this day, there really is, has been no update on the case. The lawyer in the case involved has no updates. We still don't actually know if he's fully what his situation is, what he is. And again, to remind everybody, he's 19 years old, Venezuelan, deported to a prison, not even in his country. And despite the media attention, there really has been no update as of yet.
Wilmer, I know how incredibly hard this is for you. Talk about your decision to speak out.
Bueno, yo estoy haciendo esto que se haga sentir en el mundo entero.
Well, I am doing this so that the violation that they did to all Venezuelans, including my son, is known throughout the world. Because it is really anti-human that they grab the person and treat them as they please and violate their rights. If they do not want us here, they should deport them to their native country, not send them to a prison, because they are not terrorists. They are not gang members. They do not belong to any gang or anything like that. So they are violating my son's rights and they are damaging his mind.
Están estropeando la mente. Imagínese, mi hijo es un niño todavía, porque usted lo puede ver así, pero él es un niño, en su mentalidad tampoco ha madurado. Y ahorita le están estropeando su mente. Imagínese usted.
My son is still a child. His mentality has not matured yet. And right now they are damaging his mind. Imagine what he is feeling at this moment there. Every day he wakes up knowing that they have not yet taken him out of that place where they have kidnapped him, where they are violating his human rights. I decided to speak out because I really want this to be heard, even by the president of El Salvador himself. And we ask him to respect those Venezuelans, because my son has nothing to do with all this. He has not had any problem with that country, and the president of El Salvador should release him.
Wilmer, talk about the risk you're taking in coming forward. Are you afraid that you could be next, even if your son was mistakenly taken?
Bueno. El miedo es una cosa que nos inculcan, como quien dice, pero miedo no tengo porque si mira lo que está pasando mi hijo.
Well, fear is something that they instill in us. But I am not afraid because if you look at what is happening to my son, and if something happens to me, the only thing that matters is that at least I made people aware of what has happened to my son. I made them understand that the government is violating the laws. And if they do something against people like myself, who are advocating for our relatives, then they will realize that what they are doing is a violation of human rights, because they do not want to respect the laws. They are violating them. The courts told them not to fly those planes to El Salvador, and they still did it. We can imagine what is going to happen going forward if they do not put a stop to this government, because they are violating all the laws and doing whatever they want.
Have you ever been apart from Mayor Wheel this long, for 2 months?
No, Merwil y yo siempre.
Merwil and I have always been practically like brothers, always together, until now that they have separated us.
Do you have hope that he'll be released, that you'll see him here again?
Mergul y yo, por lo menos, toda la vida hemos vivido juntos. Él siempre ha andado conmigo. Lo único...
Merwild and I have lived together all our lives. He has always been with me, and the only time we weren't together is when he was in classes in high school, focusing on his studies. He would always walk with me, work with me. When we were still living in Venezuela, we were always together. And as I am telling you now, we had never been separated until now they have separated us, and it is very hard.
If you could talk to your son right now, if you could talk to Merwil, look right into the camera, and what would you say to him?
Well, my message to Merwil, if he hears me, he is to be strong. God is with us, and he needs to know that we are doing everything possible to get him out of there soon. His family in Venezuela is doing everything they can. Just like me here, I am making my voice heard so that it is heard and reaches the ears of everyone, and that justice is done, because I told you from my heart. He is not a criminal. Not all Venezuelans are doing what Trump's government says we are doing, and I hope they have a little respect for that too. If they want to send everyone to their home country, do it with due process, not how they are doing it, as if we were criminals. Even animals don't deserve that. They treat us as if we were a commodity. And from my heart, I tell Merwil that we are doing everything possible and that we will be together soon.
Wilmer Gutierrez, father of 19-year-old Merwil Gutierrez, who is detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, by ICE agents, outside his apartment here in New York in the Bronx on February 24th, and was sent to El Salvador despite having an open asylum case in the U.S. He has not been heard from since. At CECOT, they're kept incommunicado. We'll link to the report on this case by Documented. Headlined, ICE took his son from their Bronx home, now his 19-year-old's in Bukele's mega prison in El Salvador. And you can go to our full interview with Wilmer about Merwil at our website in Spanish at democracynow.org/es. When we come back, as the United States and Ukraine sign a new rare earth minerals deal, we'll speak to the environmental journalist Antonia Yuhas. Her new piece, Is Trump's Minerals Deal a Fossil Fuel Shakedown? Stay with us.
There is power in a factory, power in the lines, power in the hand of the worker. This is much too high this time of the morning. Sorry about this, folks. Normally, I'm playing this, it's nearly midnight. And as it is here, it's 10 o'clock in the morning. There is power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The mistakes of the
Power in a Union, performed by Billy Bragg in our Democracy Now! Studio in 2011. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
U.S. and Ukrainian officials have signed a deal to give the U.S. a stake in Ukraine's mineral reserves as part of a joint investment fund with Kyiv. Details of the agreement have yet to be released, but according to the Financial Times, the deal does not include explicit security guarantees from the United States. Trump has sought to frame the agreement as repayment of U.S. military aid to Ukraine since Russia's invasion starting in February 2022. The Ukrainian parliament will still need to ratify the deal. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent spoke after signing the agreement.
Today's agreement signals clearly to Russian leadership that the Trump administration is committed to a peace process centered on a free, sovereign, and prosperous Ukraine over the long term. It's time for this cruel and senseless war to end.
We're joined now by Antonia Juhas, award-winning, longtime investigative journalist covering oil and energy. In March, Antonia wrote a piece for Rolling Stone headlined, "Is Trump's Minerals Deal a Fossil Fuel Shakedown?" She's also been reporting on the Trump administration's gutting of climate and environmental regulations and programs. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. Antonia, welcome back to Democracy Now! So if you can talk about this piece or this deal that was just signed yesterday between Ukrainian and U.S. officials, the rare earth minerals deal, what does it entail and what do you think it represents?
Sure, and thanks again for having me. Good morning. So this is actually a reconstruction investment fund set up between the U.S. and Ukraine. It's been dubbed the Minerals Deal for a while, and that's a bit of a misnomer. The original idea for the agreement started years ago after the initial Russian invasion of Ukraine, when Zelensky was trying to keep the Republican Congress willing to keep its investments going in military aid to Ukraine under the Biden administration by saying, okay, we'll give you a stake essentially in the Ukrainian economy if you'll keep supporting us. What it then morphed into under the Trump administration is really a grab of Ukraine's natural resources, some of which could involve rare earth minerals, but I would say the larger focus is Ukraine's oil, gas, coal, its fossil fuels, and opening those up to U.S. investment, but I would say even more so to Russian control. The elimination of Russian sanctions is the larger goal for Putin, and then opening up Russia once again to U.S. oil companies. And the deal that was signed yesterday has had some changes since the initial agreement was put forward in late February. And of course, that was the deal that Zelensky had come to the White House to sign at the end of February. That was the intention of that meeting in the White House that then became this complete made-for-TV moment launched by J.D. Vance and President Trump to shame Zelensky, to degrade Zelensky, to put him down in his place, to make Zelensky aware that Trump had realigned to Russia and that Zelensky was going to need to play ball on anything if he wanted anything out of the White House. This deal was supposed to be signed that day. It wasn't. There's been some negotiations since then. The deal put on the table yesterday, I would say, is certainly better than the deal that was originally presented at the end of February, but it's got a lot of problems still.
So, Antonia, could you explain what some of those problems are? I mean, Zelensky, in this highly public and contentious meeting at the White House in February, had said initially he described the draft agreement as asking him to, quote, sell his country off. So if you could say what were the obstacles then and what has been resolved in this final agreement, which still has to be ratified by the Ukrainian parliament?
Yeah, I mean, so first, let's just get what the deal entails really clear. Again, it's being called the Minerals Agreement, but Ukraine we don't know that it has a lot of minerals. It definitely has titanium. It's producing titanium and graphite. It might have lithium. It might also have a host of what are called rare earth minerals. That's 12 metals that are pretty critical for renewable energy, and there's definitely an interest and has been in Ukraine to developing the potential of those rare earth minerals. And just to say, the assessment of those minerals is based on a 50-year-old assessment done when Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. But there's domestic interest in that because there's been a domestic interest in transitioning off of fossil fuels, not only for the betterment of Ukraine, but also to weaken Russia, which is so dependent on its fossil fuels. And so there's been interest in developing those rare earth minerals. But this agreement also includes all of Ukraine's natural resources, oil, gas, coal, and all of its infrastructure as well. That's its critical pipelines that carry gas, for example, through Russia, from Russia through Ukraine, its ports and that infrastructure, its gas holding facilities, and all of that is fair game. Its nuclear facilities, its refineries. And the initial deal that was put on the table seemed to imply essentially that the United States, so it creates a fund where all of Ukraine's future profits from all of its natural resources and infrastructure would go into the fund. The U.S. would also contribute to the fund, but it was unclear how much money it would put in. And then it was also unclear and seemed to imply that the United States would have majority control over decisions on how those natural resources would be used, over how the money would be spent, and wouldn't contribute really any money into it, rather have that money be a payoff, which is how Trump was talking about it, for previous military aid to Ukraine. What's different now is that it seems clear that it's going to be a 50-50 decision-making split between the United States and Ukraine over the natural resources, over the spending of the fund, that previous military aid won't be paid off through the fund, but that any future U.S. military aid could be considered the contribution to the fund. So the U.S. wouldn't be putting money into reconstruction, it would be putting money into military aid. Now, that's better, but just to say there is no history of an agreement like this before. The United States usually provides reconstruction aid, which is grants or loans that support reconstruction. And then if it wants to invest in a country, it signs contracts to do that. You don't have an agreement that says, in exchange for us continuing to provide you military aid, we're going to gain 50% of the decision-making and control over all of your future natural resources. That's unprecedented. Honestly, even if you go back to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, even the U.S. Occupation government of Iraq wasn't this explicit in the type of control over resources that the U.S. government was going to be given. And of course, the U.S. doesn't occupy Ukraine. There's a Russian invasion of Ukraine. The other sort of key problem is that in the discussions over the agreement, Trump continually says that basically what Ukraine has gotten is we will help you get peace and you won't lose your entire country to Russia. That's, you know, what Ukraine gets. What it's likely to have to cede is Crimea and the territory that was taken by the Russians since 2014 and 2022, which also includes some of Ukraine's richest oil and gas reserves offshore, onshore, coal, and it's a lot of its industrial heart in the Donbas region. So that would mean that Russia would continue to control those areas. And again, if Trump moves forward, if Trump moves forward on eliminating sanctions, then all of Russia is opened up to U.S. oil and gas companies once again.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Antonia Juhas, award-winning, longtime investigative journalist covering oil and energy. We will link to your piece that you did recently for Rolling Stone, Is Trump's Minerals Deal a Fossil Fuel Shakedown? And have you back to talk about Trump's record on the environment. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The UN is warning ongoing U.S. attacks on Yemen pose a deadly risk to civilians after a U.S. strike on a migrant detention center in the north of the country killed at least 68 people Monday and injured dozens more. Most or all of the victims are believed to be asylum seekers from African nations. The U.S. has killed over 250 people and carried out over 800 strikes on Yemen since March 15th, after Houthi fighters vowed to resume targeting ships in the Red Sea in an attempt to pressure Israel to end its assault and siege on Gaza.
We go now to Oxford, England, where we're joined by Helen Lackner, author of several books on Yemen, including Yemen in Crisis, The Road to War, and Yemen, Poverty and conflict. She's been involved with Yemen for over half a century, lived there for a total of more than 15 years between the 1970s and the 2010s. Helen Lackner, thanks so much for being with us. 800 strikes in these last few weeks. Talk about the significance of this.
Well, thank you for showing some interest in what's happening in Yemen. Actually, by now, it's more than 1,000 strikes. So we've got much worse, and your death count is distinctly about half the actual number of people who've been killed. So basically, you've now a situation where the U.S. has been bombing Yemen on an absolutely nightly basis since the 15th of March. I think not a single night has gone by without any bombs on the area of Yemen that's controlled by the Houthi, supposedly, rebels. So this is the situation that you're dealing with. And not only, of course, have many people now been killed, but massive amounts of infrastructure has been destroyed. And people who are living in the country are suffering on a daily basis from basically terror and fright or from being attacked and possibly being bombed and killed any time.
Well, Helen Lackner, if you could also talk about other Trump policies that have immiserated a population that is already on the brink of starvation, what Trump has done both with U.S. aid together with these attacks and other steps that the government has taken, the Trump administration has taken since taking office in January.
Yes, the two other elements that are affecting the Yemeni population are, one, the complete cut of USAID and assistance. And, for example, Yemen was the worst humanitarian crisis in the world until it got overtaken by the disasters in Gaza and in Sudan. But it's not that the situation has improved in Yemen. And, for example, U.S. used to finance about 62% of the last year of the financing for the World Food Program. And this year it's financed 0% of the amount available for the World Food Program. And you have about 17 million Yemenis who are dependent on food aid in some form or shape. In addition to all the projects and other activities that were financed by USAID, which have all been stopped. The third element, which has got an even bigger and more long-term impact, has been the declaration of the Houthi movement as foreign terrorist organizations. So that has major impacts. In particular, it means that all commercial activities are going to be extremely difficult to operate throughout Yemen, whether they are under Houthi control or not, because there's very little facility for differentiating if you're a company that's importing food or that's importing medical supplies or that's importing other basic activities for Yemen. How do you prove that you're not doing it in the Houthi area, but only in the areas that are not controlled by the Houthis? So that's another element. It's also preventing the banking sector from operating. It's also preventing the humanitarian organizations from operating. It's also, of course, affecting the United Nations and the efforts to bring some kind of peace negotiations. So all these factors are extremely important in the situation in Yemen at the moment, which are all affected by the new Trump policies since January.
We just have 30 seconds, and we're going to do a post-show with you. But I wanted to ask, the U.S. says they're attacking Yemen because the Houthis are attacking ships in the Red Sea. Can you explain why they're doing this?
Well, number one, the Houthis have completely stopped attacking ships in the Red Sea after the Gaza ceasefire started in January. And they were threatening to restart them, but they did not restart them. And the only things they've been attacking in the Red Sea in the last few weeks have been the U.S. Ship military targets that have been going there. Basically, the Houthis have been doing all whatever they have done in that sector, as well as launching missiles and drones towards Israel, has been with the intention of assisting the Palestinian movement.
Helen Lackner, we want to thank you for being with us. Covered Yemen for half a century, author of Yemen.